Executive Power Disc 3.
Chapter 12.
David's patriarchal society, the distinction between a woman who willingly commits adultery and one who is forcibly raped, is often lost. The honor of the family, which really means the honor of the father, is above all else. David looked down at the poor, frightened kid in the corner and struggled over what to do with her. He knew he should have never untied her. He should have simply shot Hamza in the back of the head, dispatched the two bodyguards, and left. If he'd stuck with his original plan, he'd be long gone by now, miles of safe distance between himself and the crime. The maid would show up in the morning and find the young girl, and she would be taken to a hospital. Everything would have turned out just fine for her. As much as he wanted to believe it, though, he knew that was far from what would really happen. The maid would have called the police, who would very quickly discover they had a dead Iraqi general on their hands. The media would find out shortly after that, and this little innocent girl would get swept up in the maelstrom that would follow. The police and reporters would talk to her parents, and the entire neighborhood would find out that the young girl had been sexually assaulted. Through no fault of her own, she would be shunned and treated as a pariah for the rest of her years. David wasn't about to let that happen. When he'd started down this dangerous path years before, he'd made a promise to himself. David hadn't grown up in the camps, but his mother had been sure to bring him along whenever she visited the various clinics. She wanted him to see firsthand the squalor that Palestinian people were forced to live in. His mother, unique in more ways than he could ever count, used the long car rides to and from the camps to enlighten her only son on the politics of the most contested region in the history of mankind. The camps were a breeding ground for discontent, corruption, and anti-Semitism. The Jews were blamed for everything, both real and imagined, consequential and inconsequential. They were the evil, greedy Zionists who had stolen the land away from the Palestinian people. The propaganda was insidious, but his mother had been very careful to teach David about the complicated history of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Jews. In her mind, there was more than enough blame to go around. For a brief period in 1948, the Palestinians actually had a state, but instead of taking what the United Nations had legally mandated, they decided to attack the fledgling country of Israel with the help of 5 Arab armies. The decision proved disastrous. Israel trounced the Arab armies, seized the land that had been set aside for the Palestinian state, and deported most of the Palestinians who hadn't already left. David's mother liked to point out that it was a little disingenuous of their people to cry that Israel had stolen their land. She was fond of asking him, "If we had won the war back in 48, do you think we would have allowed the Jews to keep their land?" She never waited for him to answer. The reply was always a resounding no. The Arab armies would have killed every last Jew. "The Jews are racists," she used to tell him. "But the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, and the Saudis are all worse. The Jews hate us because we've given them no reason to like us. But what excuse do our Arab brothers have? They have none. We are beneath them. That is the way they feel. They have kept our people in these camps and stoked the flames of hatred toward the Jews to serve their own corrupt governments. We are servants to them, a useful tool in their campaign to keep their subjects' anger focused not on them, but on the evil Jews." His mother's teachings had made David wary of all propaganda. He refused to allow hatred to drive his ambition. He would never allow himself to turn a blind eye to the truth. He would never allow himself to become just another cold-blooded killer. That was why he didn't just shoot Hamza and leave the poor girl to be discovered in the morning. David truly was a unique man. He was a pragmatist with a heart. The girl would be brought with him now, and an explanation and some cash would be given to her father later. He finished tying the general's wrists and ankles to the bed, and then hovered over him for a moment. General Hamza had spent the better part of 30 years inflicting pain on people, destroying lives and ruining dreams. A bullet in the head was too good for him. Hamza needed to experience the fear he had so perversely meted out to so many souls. David wanted to see real fear in the man's eyes. He pulled his knife from its leather scabbard with his right hand and slapped Hamza's cheek with his left. The Iraqi thug's jaw hung loose. Reaching in with his thumb and forefinger, David grabbed the tip of Hamza's tongue and pulled it taut. The general started to stir. David tightened his grip and angled the tip of the 4-inch blade into Hamza's mouth. A quick upward slicing motion, and a good 70% of Hamza's tongue was severed from his mouth. With perfect timing, the general's eyes shot open, just in time to watch David tear the rest of his tongue out. The Iraqi general, his eyes ablaze with fear and agony, let out a low, guttural moan that, because he no longer had his tongue, never quite elevated itself to a scream. Immediately he began to slash about like a landed fish in the bottom of a boat. He struggled against his bonds, trying to break free, struggling to comprehend what was happening. His last memories were deliciously good ones, and now he was tied to this bed with some masked man sitting on his chest, dangling a piece of meat in front of his face. Making matters worse, his mouth was on fire with a pain that his brain could not identify. A warm liquid trickled down his throat and caused him to gag when it dribbled into his windpipe. Suddenly, the pieces fell into place. In a panic, Hamza lifted his head off the pillow and tried to speak. All that came out were a jumble of primitive noises. The masked man sitting on top of him wasn't holding a piece of meat. He was holding Hamza's tongue. David dropped the fleshy organ onto Hamza's bare chest and reached into his own pocket. He grabbed a pack of crisp, counterfeit $100 bills and waved them in front of the general's face. He didn't need to speak. Neither did the general, although he tried. There was instant recognition in his eyes. David crumpled a dozen of the new bills into a ball, and with the tip of his blood-soaked knife, he pried open the general's lips. He crammed the wad in and then added two more fistfuls of money until Hamza's mouth was overflowing with bills. Moving quickly, he shoved another pillow under Hamza's head and then got off him. Taking a moment to relish the sadistic bastard's fear, David looked down at him and shook his head in disgust. He wondered if this butcher of Saddam's had ever granted someone a reprieve, if he had ever felt an ounce of guilt over his actions or pity for the people he had so brutally tortured. As David looked into Hamza's fearful eyes, he knew the answer was no. Monsters like Hamza were wired differently. Their brains worked in ways normal people could never understand. David felt no shame in what he was about to do. He felt no pity for Hamza. This would be justice in its purest form. Hamza would die in a manner commensurate with his crimes of brutality. David tossed the rest of the $100 bills onto the bed. They lay strewn about from one side to the other. Hamza looked down at the bills and tried to signal something with his eyes. David ignored him and walked to the foot of the bed, holding the knife up in the air. He stopped in between the general's spread legs and looked down. Placing one knee on the bed, he reached out with his gloved hand and grabbed Hamza by his genitals. The general's entire body convulsed in fear. Straining against his bonds, he thrashed his head from side to side, a hideous noise rising up from his chest, only to be stifled by the bloody bundle of worthless bills in his mouth. David did not hesitate or waver. He pulled hard with his left hand and reached out with the knife. It took 4 slices, and there David stood, with General Hamza's genitals in his hand. He held them before the Iraqi's horrified eyes and then simply dropped the bloody mess on his chest along with his tongue. Standing over him, David contemplated finishing him off, but decided against it. It was unlikely anyone would visit the room before morning, and by then Hamza would surely have bled to death. It was more fitting to let him slowly die while staring at his lifeless sex organs, unable to scream for help, unable to move a limb to stem the bleeding. he would know the same helpless horror of his victims. And if someone came earlier and managed to save him, that wouldn't be all that bad either. Hamza would spend his remaining days a castrated, prickless mute. Chapter 13. The high, billowing clouds had moved on, and the mid-morning sun was poking its way through the trees of the rose garden. The president sat behind his desk, elbows planted on the armrests of his Kevlar-lined leather chair. His hands were clasped in front of his chin, the crisp white sleeves of his dress shirt forming a pyramid before him. He was engrossed in what he was being told by his guest. Mitt Rapp, his dark suit coat open and his hands on his hips, strode back and forth across the blue rug of the Oval Office. The man moved with an athletic grace that hinted at his many talents. As he walked, he laid out the operation for the president. Director Kennedy and General Flood sat in silence while Rapp paced behind them. Rapp had been talking without interruption for nearly 5 minutes. He was about to go over the final part of the plan, but decided at the last minute to pause. Looking down to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Rapp said, "General, if you would like to excuse yourself from the room at this point, I would completely understand." The general scratched his chin and, in a surprisingly light-hearted tone, replied, "I think I've got an idea where you're going with this, and I'm guessing you're not worried about offending me." Rapp grinned. "General, I'm not sure it would be possible for me to offend you with words alone." With a laugh, the general said, "As long as you leave my wife and children out of it, I'd say you're right. I assume you're offering me a chance to excuse myself from the really nasty part of this in case it goes south." "That would be correct." There was a fairly long pause before the general answered, and then he said, "My wife likes to accuse me of having selective memory." Looking up at Rapp, he added, "You know what I mean?" "I think I do." Rapp smiled, and then turned back to the president. "As long as I'm over in the Philippines, I think it would be a good idea to stop by and visit General Morrow." The president shifted uncomfortably in his chair. A voice in the back of his head was telling him to just nod, tell Rapp to have a good trip and then get on with his day, but another part of him wanted to know more. "And what will you be discussing with General Morrow?" Rapp stopped with his shoulders squared to the president and looked down at his shoes for a moment. "Sir, does the First Lady ever accuse you of having selective memory?" "Ever since the day I met her. And truth be told, she's right. But that's not the point." The president spun his chair a quarter turn and looked out the window. "Mitch, I'm not comfortable having you stick your neck out this far." "Don't worry about me, sir. That's what I'm paid for." The president nodded. "Yeah, I know you are, but that doesn't give the rest of us the excuse to say we were kept in the dark every time something goes wrong." "Sir," said Kennedy with great sincerity, "that's the way it has to be." "Well, that doesn't mean I have to like it. And to be honest, I'm not so sure eliminating General Morrow will do anything other than satiate our short-term need for blood." Rapp frowned at the president's words. In his tactical mind, bloodlust had no bearing on whether Morrow deserved to die or live. "Mr. President," Rapp said in a voice that was neither pleading nor condescending, "General Morrow is a traitorous bastard who is directly responsible for the death of 2 United States Navy SEALs. And if you're worried about offending President Quirino, I can assure you that after she finds out Morrow was a paid informant for both the Chinese and Abu Sayyaf, she'll be thanking us for getting rid of him." The president tapped his finger on his lips a few more times, and then, leaning forward and grabbing a file, announced, "Let me think about all this, and I'll get back to you." Rapp didn't have to be a seasoned Washington bureaucrat to recognize a brush-off. Not one to give in so easily, he stood his ground and asked, "When will you have an answer for me, sir?" Hayes eyed Rapp cautiously for a second and said, "In a couple of days." Rapp shook his head. "That won't work, sir. Once the story breaks on the ambassador in Petrie, our ability to move on Morrow will be compromised." Hayes again leaned back in his chair and exhaled. "Listen," he said in a no-nonsense tone, From what you've told me this morning, this General Morrow deserves to rot in a cell for the rest of his life. But as far as assassinating him goes, I'm not so sure. The fallout could be very ugly, and to be honest with you, we really need the Philippine government with us in this fight. So as I said, I'm going to need a few days to consider our options. Having spoken his piece, Hayes spun his chair away from Rapp and opened the file he'd grabbed off his desk. Rapp watched him with curiosity and then looked down at Kennedy for guidance. She stood and motioned toward the door with a jerk of her thumb. She looked at General Flood and did the same thing. Reluctantly, Rapp followed her orders and began to leave the famed office, wondering how many other people over the years had felt his same sense of frustration. As he placed his hand on the doorknob, he heard Kennedy say to the president, "Sir, I need to have a word alone with you." Rapp grinned ever so slightly as he looked back at his boss. Kennedy, despite her subdued demeanor, could be surprisingly persuasive. He felt confident that by the time she left the office, they would have the approval they were looking for. Chapter 14. David's demeanor was calm, though perhaps slightly distracted, as he walked down Via Dolorosa, passing from the Muslim quarter of the old city to the Christian quarter. It was a walk he'd taken countless times. In his youth, he did so without a care in the world. But as he grew older, he began to see things, to notice the dangers that lurked in the entryways of the storefronts, in the eyes of the old men selling fruit and nuts on the street, and the women running errands. There were spies and informants everywhere. It was in the 13th year of his life that innocence had been beaten from his body. He still carried scars from that day, both physical and mental, but he never spoke of them. The eyes of the street spies no longer intimidated David as they had in the years after the beating. He was above reproach by such people. If he chose, he could have any one of them killed with a single order. But that was not who Jabril Katabi was. His parents had raised someone infinitely more judicious. He used his power with great care, discretion, and patience. Now, more than ever, he needed those three traits. More than 20 years passed. He had been walking down this same street in Jerusalem when he had been snatched in broad daylight and thrown into the trunk of a car. His own people thought he had been collaborating with the Jews. Back then, they had been wrong. David had been nothing more than an innocent boy walking through the old city on his way to meet his mother at the hospital. Today, all was different. If the PLO or Hamas or Hezbollah or any one of a dozen groups had any idea what he was up to, they would torture him until he begged to die. Casually, he took a right onto Bab el-Jadid and eyed the checkpoint up ahead. The old city was surrounded by a fortress-like wall constructed by Suleiman the Magnificent in A.D. 1540. Through this wall there were just 7 gates. It was through these gates over the centuries that the conquerors had controlled who and what came and went from the city. In the last century alone, the city had been guarded by 4 countries. The Turks, the Brits, the Jordanians, and now the Israelis manned the ramparts. Soldiers from the Israeli Defense Forces, dressed in green uniforms and bulbous helmets, checked the IDs of everyone trying to enter and leave the city. David remained calm as he continued toward the gate and his meeting just beyond. There were many informants lurking about on this stretch of his journey. The Arab eyes were always watchful, reporting everything they saw or suspected to the Palestine Liberation Organization. The distrustful eyes of his brethren haunted him, reminding him of the need for his mission to succeed. The Palestinian people needed to bury their hatred if they ever truly wanted peace for their children. But in history's most oxymoronic way, they would first have to wage war. At this appointed hour, however, David suspected that there were also at least an equal number of Jewish eyes about. They wouldn't know who he was or the importance of the errand that he was on, though, for he was far too valuable to be trusted with any but Mossad's best and bravest. Mossad, Israel's vaunted intelligence service, did not suffer the counterintelligence woes of other countries due to the simple fact that their agents were fiercely loyal to both country and cause. They were, however, not entirely out of harm's way. Agents had been kidnapped by Israel's various enemies and made to reveal valuable secrets. That was more than reason enough for David's contact to hold very close to his vest the identity of his most prized asset. As David approached the new gate, which had been cut into the wall of the old city in 1887, he readied his papers. He presented them to a young Israeli soldier and was allowed to pass. He quickly crossed the street, and after once again presenting his papers, he was admitted onto foreign soil. Notre Dame de France was owned by the Catholic Church and housed, among many things, the papal delegation to Christendom's holiest city. David's excuse for visiting such a place was less awkward than it might seem. He had explained many times to his Palestinian brethren that the delegation also held a branch office of the Vatican Bank. And no one, not even the Swiss, were as discreet when it came to banking matters as the Vatican. The leadership of the PLO did not question David in this regard, as long as he kept raising capital and funding their operations. They had little interest in the intricacies of international finance. David was met by a youthful priest from Italy and escorted to the second-floor office of Monsignor Terence Lavin. The short and portly Monsignor tore his spectacles from his face and stood to greet his handsome guest. "Jabril, how are you, my son?" David clasped the Monsignor's pale, fleshy hand. "I am well, Terence, and you?" Looking up with his sparkling blue eyes, the older man said, "I would be better if we were having some fine French cuisine downstairs, but I have been told I am not allowed to ply you with food and wine today." The priest looked quickly at the closed door behind him and made a face. Raising a conspiratorial eyebrow, David shrugged and said, "I would very much like that, but I'm afraid our mutual friend is calling the shots." David enjoyed Monsignor Lavin very much. A true Renaissance man, as they like to say in the church, he held advanced degrees in law, finance, theology, and philosophy, and was a connoisseur of fine wine, good food, and classical music. David had met him many years ago through his parents and had often looked to the worldly priest to help expand his mind. "Well," commented Lavin, "we will have to reschedule when you have some time." The priest grabbed a file from his desk and said, "The business that we supposedly discussed today." He handed it to David. "I have prepared a report of your holdings with us and how they've performed over the last month. The standard stuff. Take a look at it before you leave, in case your friends decide today is the day they feel like being educated." With that, Lavin led his visitor to a dark, stained, heavy wood door behind his desk and opened it. David thanked him and stepped into the shadowy, windowless room. The Vatican took their security as seriously as any great nation. They had secrets that needed to be kept, relationships that needed to be cloaked, and enemies that were none too fond of them. David had come to this room many times. Located on the interior of the second floor, its four walls were covered with massive old tapestries that he guessed hid counter-bugging devices. Like much of Jerusalem, it smelled old. On this day, as on many others, the stale odor made him think of death. An old wisp of a man sat silently at the far end of the table. A yellowed lamp in the corner cast a faint glow. The man's name was Abe Spielman. David had known him now for 22 years. Father Lavin had introduced them to each other, and David had never bothered to ask if that introduction was of the priest's own volition or if Spielman had pushed for it. Lavin had always acted as if it were his idea, but now that he was older and a bit wiser, David would have to guess that it was Spielman who had wanted to meet him. It would be very much in character with the old man. He was infinitely patient and had a knack for judging both people and situations far in advance of others. Abe Spielman was a spy. At 81, he'd slowed down quite a bit, and if people took that to mean he was less than sharp, that was fine with him. He had spent an entire career trying to get his adversaries to underestimate him, and to a great extent he'd succeeded. You wouldn't know it by looking at this gentle grandfatherly figure, But there had been a time when Abe Spielman had been a warrior of the finest order, both for Britain in World War II and then again during his country's fight for independence in 1948. His bravery throughout those heady days was legendary. It was after the War of Independence that Spielman retreated into the shadows and went to work for his new country's intelligence service. He went on to become one of Mossad's most highly decorated operatives, but only a few people actually knew of his exploits, and most of them were dead, or near death. Abe Spielman was a scholar, a writer of books, and a professor of theology and history, who just so happened to moonlight as a spy, or vice versa. He gazed down the length of the heavy wood table. The sight of the young man before him, so full of vigor and youth, reminded him of just how old he was. "Excuse me for not getting up to greet you, Jabril." The voice was raspy and slightly unsteady. "Don't be silly, Abe," laughed David. "You don't need to get up for me." He crossed around the room and extended a warm hand. Spielman took it weakly in his own and said, "Please, sit. Tell me how you've been, my friend."
"I've been fine," David dropped gracefully into the chair on Spielman's left. "And you?"
"Fine." He clasped his hands and added, "My graduate assistants do most of my work now, so I can focus on my writing."
"Is that good or bad?"
Spielman frowned. "A bit of both, I suppose. I miss the kids mostly, their youthful exuberance."
"But you don't miss the politics of the university?"
David knew that his old friend felt very strongly about the takeover of Hebrew University by the ultra-Orthodox rabbis of his religion. "They will be the end of us all. You know it as well as I. The zealots of Judaism and the zealots of Islam will drive us all right into the abyss."
David nodded knowingly. They had discussed it for years. After a long, reflective moment, he said, "If there were more people like us, peace wouldn't be such a problem."
"Problem?" Spielman wryly noted the use of the word in relation to peace.
There was a time not so long ago when he thought he would see peace between the two peoples of Palestine. But now he felt that elusive prize slipping over the horizon. He'd dreamt of an armistice between Arabs and Jews for many years. He knew that for his tiny nation to survive long term, they would need to forge a real and lasting friendship with their neighbors. In recent years, though, that had all slipped away.
"I do not think I will see peace in my lifetime."
David noted that there was genuine sadness in the old man's eyes when he spoke. In an encouraging voice, he said, "It might not be as far off as you think, Abe." Spielman shook his head.
"No, there is no hope. Things are worse today than they have ever been, short of the War of Independence. When teenage girls begin strapping bombs to themselves and blowing themselves up in public, we have reached a level of despair and hatred that the world has rarely seen."
"Not even with the Nazis?" asked David, a bit skeptically.
"The Nazis were bullies, inhumane, cold-hearted butchers. They detested us, but in their minds we were beneath them."
The professor paused for a moment and then added,
"These martyrs that we are facing today hate us with every ounce of their being. But they also think that we are the villains, the cause of all their problems."
He added sadly,
"I warned my people years ago that these camps would someday be our undoing. Everyone ignored me, though. Apparently, there were better things to spend our money on."
Spielman frowned at the short-sightedness of politicians.
"When you take away all hope, when you treat people as if they are no better than animals, undeserving of respect and compassion, do not be surprised one day when the whole lot of them rise up and shake off their bonds. It is the story of my own people being led from Egypt by Moses."
"Except the Palestinians," added David, "are already home."
"Exactly. They are not going anywhere.
They want us to leave. For the first time they have seen hope in these so-called martyrs. They dance in the street when innocent Jewish women and children are killed. Are not innocent Palestinian women and children killed by your tanks and your missiles? David parried. Spielman eyed the younger man like a stern father. You do not see Jews dancing in the street when a Palestinian baby is born from the rubble. David nodded. It was an ugly reality that his people not only rationalized the murder of civilians, but celebrated each death as if it were a glorious event. The day of a Palestinian state is not far off. The economy of Israel cannot hang on much longer. Tourism has all but withered away. If it were not for the Americans propping us up, we wouldn't last more than a week. Yes, Jabril, you will get your state, and then there will be great bloodshed. Jewish settlers will refuse to leave the occupied territories, and the bigots that your people look to for guidance will never be satisfied until all of Palestine is cleansed of Jewish blood. We will continue in this downward death spiral for years. He shook his head sadly. And I am afraid my people no longer have the stomach it will take for such a fight. David nodded thoughtfully. Everything the elderly Jew said he agreed with, especially the last part. It was, in fact, the reason why he was here. I agree with much of what you say, but I am not quite so fatalistic.
That is because you are young. You have many years ahead of you where I have only but a few. My faith in humanity has dwindled over this past decade. I feel as if we are settling into a dark period.
David reached out for the old man's hand. Do not give up hope just yet. With a smile, he added, A meeting is set to take place tomorrow evening. David pulled a small sheet of paper from his shirt pocket and slid it in front of Spielman. On the list were eight names that were sure to grab the professor's attention. Spielman donned a pair of reading glasses and glanced over the list. His mouth went completely dry. The list was a virtual who's who of terrorists in the occupied territories. It was more than he'd bargained for. When he began cultivating a relationship with Jabril many years ago, he knew the young Palestinian had the potential to do great things. Jabril's parents were rationalists who placed a high value on education and shunned the violence and fiery rhetoric of the PLO. Spielman thought that Jabril might someday be a real leader of his people. But as much as he thought their friendship might someday bear the fruit of good intelligence, he never thought it would lead to such a staggering moment. Mossad had kept an eye on him, discovering only recently the young Palestinian's successes at raising money for the various terrorist groups. All the while, Spielman had kept the backdoor relationship open through Monsignor Levin. Along the way, it had been very beneficial. He had gained a true friend in Jabril, a pragmatist who believed in peace. Holding the piece of paper up in the air, the sage, Spielman, said,
This is an interesting group.
Very. Spielman held the younger man in his gaze.
I suppose you wouldn't like to tell me where this meeting will be taking place?
David bit down on his lip, and after some serious consideration, he slid a second piece of paper across the table. It contained a sketch and the dimensions of an attaché case. I need two of them. Have your people build them to my specifications, and I will meet you here again tomorrow to discuss the details. Spielman cautiously surveyed the young Palestinian for a sign that his gesture was anything other than genuine, for if it was, Abe Spielman had just been given the golden nugget that every intelligence officer searches a lifetime for. Chapter 15. Rapp sat awkwardly over a laptop, his muscular arms contorted so he could peck at the keys. He stopped reading the profile on the screen and looked out the porthole of the agency's Gulfstream V long-range jet. As far as the eye could see was an endless stretch of blue water. The plane was outfitted with a VIP package, plush leather seats, a couch, galley, head, bedroom, and a secure communications system that allowed the team to stay in touch with Washington without fear of being intercepted. Rapp didn't know how she'd pulled it off, but she had. Kennedy had convinced the president to give his approval to the operation or turn a blind eye. Either way, it didn't much matter to Rapp. He caught himself. That wasn't entirely true. He did care. It was infinitely better if the president turned a blind eye to the goings-on of the Orion team and their dark operations. As far as the American people were concerned, Rapp honestly felt that the vast majority didn't want to know what he was up to. America had been attacked. The country was at war, and war was ugly. They didn't want to see the gruesome details of how it was fought. They didn't start the war, but they sure as hell didn't want to lose it. They wanted someone like Mitch Rapp to take care of the dirty work. The chief problem lay, as always, with the politicians. They would use any issue to gain the upper hand on an opponent. Scandal is what they were in constant search of, so consequently, the fewer people who knew at the White House, the better his chances of staying under the Washington radar. If President Hayes wanted to insulate himself politically, so be it. From an operational standpoint, it was a far more desirable situation. If the president didn't want to be associated with the op, it would ensure that he wouldn't be discussing it with any of his advisors, and the probability of another leak would be reduced. From the standpoint of morale, it was a less palatable situation, however. Not that morale mattered much to Rapp. He didn't need his hand held. He didn't need to be pumped up. No pre-game speeches were required. Early in his career as a counterterrorism operative, he'd once heard a special forces officer give his men a talk before launching a hostage rescue. The officer assembled his team and simply said, "If you need a pep talk right now, you're in the wrong line of work. We all know why we're here, so let's load up and get this done." No one said a word. No one needed to. That scene had stayed with Rapp all these years. He was only 23 at the time. 12 of the calmest, coolest badasses he'd ever met climbed onto 2 Black Hawk helicopters and went out and performed their jobs to absolute perfection. It was one of the most beautiful things he'd ever seen. Despite his natural preference for operational security, Rapp couldn't help but feel disappointed in the president. He'd thought better of the man. Rapp was starting to wonder if Robert Hayes was losing his determination in the battle against terrorism. Up until now, Hayes's commitment had been unwavering. Why he'd now decided to get gun-shy was a mystery. When Rapp had gone into the Oval Office this morning, he'd honestly thought the president wouldn't need more than 2 seconds to sign on. When Rapp got back to Washington, he'd make it a point to talk to Kennedy about the president. If anyone knew what was going on, it would be her. Kennedy was an amazing woman. Even after the president had given him the cold shoulder, he knew Kennedy would succeed. Her powers of persuasion were so total that Rapp liked to joke if she got tired of running the CIA, she could go to work for the D.C. police, talking jumpers off a ledge. Her ability to navigate her way through Washington's political maze was amazing. With all this fresh on his mind, Rapp had put the wheels in motion the moment he left the White House. His first call had been to the Seal Demolition and Salvage Corporation out of Baltimore, where he spoke to an individual who he'd worked with many times before. Since they were talking on an unsecured line, the conversation had been brief and cryptic, but enough information was passed along that the man on the other end could begin to assemble his team and prepare to leave on very short notice. The rest of the drive back to Langley was spent talking to his new bride. In her mind, the day they got married was the day her husband was to retire from field operations, and Rapp, at least, when they got engaged, thought so too. The problem was, between the engagement and the wedding, he'd been forced to sit through an endless succession of meetings where little was accomplished. He was quick to come to the realization that retiring from the field might not be as easy as he thought. Simply holding down an office job was never going to cut it. He knew it, and she knew it. But they were both in agreement that the really dangerous operations were out of the picture. Rapp saw himself taking a very active role in planning operations. He might not be the man pulling the trigger anymore, but he sure as hell wasn't going to sit in his cushy office in Virginia doling out orders from thousands of miles away. There was a reason why military commanders favored the opinions of on-site commanders, and that was why Rapp would be running this op in person. There was nothing arrogant about it, but the truth was there was no one he trusted more to get it done right. Anna, always the inquisitive reporter, asked a solid minute's worth of questions. Each one came from a different angle, and each one was met with the standard, "You know I can't answer that." There was one question, however, that he could answer. Anna wanted to know if it would be dangerous. Mitch laughed and told her, "No." And to his way of thinking, at least, it was the truth. There was little doubt, however, that if Anna knew what he had planned, she would disagree with him vehemently. Setting her opinion aside, in Rapp's brutally lethal world, this op didn't score too high on the danger list, and depending on how the final pieces were put into play, the op might actually present no direct threat to him whatsoever. Something told him he wasn't being totally honest with himself. But at present, he wasn't willing to explore it much further. Right now, he had the calm sense of clarity he always felt before a mission. Like any predator, he was comfortable with only brief periods of inaction. He never felt more alive than when he was moving forward with a plan. His intellect came to life. He saw things with a heightened sense of awareness. Possibilities opened up before his mind, with paths to take and options to choose from, while the entire time he subconsciously calculated the odds for success and set the information aside. There was something else, though, something he'd never discussed with anyone, not even Kennedy. When he stripped everything away and forced himself to be brutally honest, he was left with the undeniable fact that he enjoyed killing men like General Morrow. At first he had been embarrassed by these feelings, uncomfortable with the knowledge that he took pleasure in something so brutal. But with time and maturity, he had grown comfortable with the knowledge that he was killing men who had made a conscious choice to do harm. Morrow was a traitor of his own volition, and when you plowed through all the political horseshit, the Anderson family had been minding their own business, breaking no laws. When they were snatched from their seaside resort, they were non-combatants in a war that had nothing to do with them. Morrow had decided to climb into bed with the enemy, and because of him, the Andersons were still held hostage, and two U.S. commandos were now dead. Rapp knew that just planning this operation wouldn't be enough. He wanted to be there. He wanted to see the look on the general's face when he knew it was over. He wanted to reach out and tear the man's throat out with his bare hands. Rapp's thoughts of bloodlust were interrupted by a presence hovering over his shoulder. Reaching up, he closed his laptop and turned to see who it was. Special Agent Skip McMahon of the FBI placed one of his Popeye-like forearms on the top of the seat next to Rapp and frowned. A bit of a fashion throwback, McMahon had on a short-sleeve white dress shirt with a striped tie. In a deep, gravelly voice, he asked, "What are you up to, secret agent man?" Rapp smiled. McMahon was one of the few people he knew who had absolutely no problem giving him shit. "Just a little homework?" McMahon took a seat across from him, letting his tired, beat-up body slump into the leather chair. "Homework, huh?" he said in a skeptical voice. McMahon studied Rapp with his probing eyes. In his more than 30 years with the Bureau, McMahon had hunted bank robbers, kidnappers, killers, serial killers, terrorists, cyberpunks, spies, several federal judges, and a few politicians to boot. He was a tenacious, no-nonsense lawman who the Bureau often called on when they needed results. He was loved by the few people who truly understood him, and hated by the army of bureaucrats in dark suits who were more concerned with protocol than results. But even the pension gang at the FBI had a grudging respect for McMahon. In a place where 99.9% of the employees had never discharged their weapon in the line of duty, McMahon had done so on more occasions than he cared to count. He wasn't a lawyer or an accountant. He was an old-fashioned law enforcement officer.
"So who's General Morrow?"
asked McMahon, his eyes staying locked on Rapp. Rapp didn't answer at first. He cursed himself silently for allowing McMahon to read his computer screen, and then he tried to figure out how much he should say. McMahon had been brought along to conduct surveillance on Ambassador Cox, and when Rapp gave him the word, he was to arrest the ambassador and escort him back to the United States. The president had personally asked for McMahon at the urging of CIA Director Kennedy. Kennedy and McMahon had a relationship that went beyond work. How far beyond? Rapp had never been comfortable in asking, but McMahon was ideal for the job. He had a reputation as someone who could turn a blind eye to certain things if need be. Rapp figured McMahon could find out who the general was with one phone call, so he told him the truth. He's with the Philippine Army.
No shit, McMahon said, feigning surprise. I don't know if I ever could have figured that one out.
McMahon scratched one of his hairy forearms and asked,
So what's your interest in the man? Is he friend or foe?
Rapp smiled. Tread lightly, Skip.
Or what? I might step in dog shit?
McMahon's face contorted into an annoyed grimace.
Come on, Mitch, I step in dog shit for a living. And don't give me any of that need-to-know crap. I know plenty about you and...
McMahon leaned forward, pointing over his shoulder with his thumb.
I also know a fair amount about Blondie sitting up there. I don't know who the other guys are, but I can take an awfully damn good educated guess that they're pretty handy with a gun, and they probably know all that kung fu shit they teach you guys. So,
McMahon leaned in even closer,
why don't we just cut to the chase and save each other a lot of time and effort?
Rapp shook his head with amusement. The Blondie Skip was referring to was Scott Coleman, the former commander of SEAL Team 6. Coleman, retired from the Navy, now ran an outfit called SEAL Demolition and Salvage Corporation. They did a fair amount of legitimate work training local police departments from Baltimore down to Norfolk on scuba techniques and underwater salvage. But unofficially, they also worked from time to time as freelance operatives for the CIA. McMahon and Coleman had crossed paths several years back during a very high-profile murder investigation. The case had never been brought to trial, but both Rapp and McMahon knew the truth about the events that surrounded the sensational murders. Scott Coleman had been a major player in that drama. McMahon had been chosen to come along for the very reason that he could be trusted. He wasn't some hotshot Fed who would try to burn the CIA so he could advance his career. McMahon understood that they were all on the same team. Nonetheless, Rapp wasn't all that comfortable with sharing highly classified information.
Skip, believe me when I tell you, you don't want to dig too deep on this one.
McMahon's frown turned into a scowl.
Mitch?
His tone left no doubt that he wasn't buying the tired old line.
I don't need bodyguards, and you sure as hell don't need bodyguards. I should be able to handle arresting the ambassador all on my own, so there's only one reason I can think of why you'd bring these four Boy Scouts halfway around the world.
Rapp slid his laptop off to the side and reluctantly made a decision. You familiar with the Anderson kidnapping?
Yep.
McMahon paused for a moment, and then his eyes got real tight. He'd been briefed by Kennedy herself about why the ambassador was being arrested. He knew about the leak, the two dead Navy SEALs, and the failed hostage rescue. It didn't take him long to realize that General Morrow was involved in this, and probably not in a good way.
Is Morrow a man we can trust?
Rapp shook his head. McMahon nodded slowly.
I see.
Any more questions? The big FBI agent had a cheerful glint in his eye. Slipping out of his chair, he patted Rapp on the shoulder and said,
No, I think I can fill in the blanks. But for Christ's sake, be careful.
Smiling, Rapp said, Always. Chapter 16. The plane touched down at the old Clark Air Base at 3 a.m. There was no fanfare, no military band, no diplomatic reception. The old base had been turned over to the Philippine government, when they chose not to renew the U.S. Air Force's lease. This was an unscheduled, unannounced arrival. The Gulfstream was met by a tired-looking ground crew that was more concerned with rubbing the sleep from their eyes than who was on the plane. A fuel truck pulled up alongside the jet almost immediately, and two men went to work filling the plane's tanks. McMahon left the plane first. He was met by the embassy's FBI man, who, according to plan, should have been roused from a dead sleep just an hour ago and told to get his ass to the base to pick up someone important. McMahon was that man, and once he was alone with the agent, he would put the fear of God into him. No one at the embassy was to know he was in the country until he said so. McMahon was going to keep a real close eye on Ambassador Cox, and when the word was given, he would slap the cuffs on him. After McMahon was gone, Rapp walked down the short stairs holding a file under his arm. Despite the sticky humidity, he was wearing an olive drab vest like the ones photographers wore. The lightweight vest was designed with plenty of pockets inside and out and was great for holding things like lenses and extra film. Or, in Rapp's case, extra clips of ammunition, a silencer for his 9mm Beretta, and a secure satellite phone. A black Lincoln Continental sat in the shadows next to one of the large gray hangars. When Rapp reached the tarmac, the sedan's lights flashed three times. Rapp took a look around and then nodded to Coleman, who was standing on the top step. The former SEAL ducked back inside and hit a button. The stairs retracted into the closed position, and the sleek white jet began to move once again. Rapp walked over to the car. The back door swung open, and he stopped to take one last look at the Gulfstream, which was taxiing for takeoff. He stepped in, closed the door, and turned to meet his contact. Lieutenant General Sergio Rizal looked back at Rapp with a pair of discerning dark eyes. Rizal was the head of the Philippine Army. He was a graduate of West Point and a staunch American ally. He and General Flood had a good working relationship that went all the way back to Vietnam. Pudgy-faced and short-limbed, the 58-year-old had a little pot belly that strained against the buttons of his camouflage battle dress uniform. Rizal was deeply concerned about his country. He had been sickened when, in the early 90s, the radicals in his government refused to renew the leases for the American military bases. After 21 years of dictatorial abuse by Ferdinand Marcos and his wife Imelda, the Filipino people rebelled against the military and its American backers. The radicals got their way, the Americans left, the aid dried up, and an already slumping economy worsened. It wasn't long before the Muslim and communist guerrilla groups, who had been kept at bay by the Marcos regime, renewed their efforts to destroy the democracy. They concentrated on the outer islands and began wreaking havoc across the far-flung archipelago. Morale in the Philippine Army worsened with each year and with each subsequent decrease in funds. The communists were working their way into the government through the Socialist Party and were doing everything they could to frustrate the military in their campaign to keep the country unified. After a decade of disastrous policy from the leadership in Manila, it had finally been decided that maybe it wasn't such a bad thing having the Americans around. The door was reopened a bit. Quietly, the United States military began leasing portions of the bases, and the vaunted Green Berets began instructing the Philippine Army on how to take the battle to the rebels. Much-needed economic and military aid was increased, but in these tumultuous times, Rizal wondered if it was enough to turn the tide. The enemy forces were already formidable, and now this American was here to tell him he had a traitor in his own inner circle. For the first time in his military career, General Rizal felt that his country might be beyond saving. Rapp made no effort to introduce himself. He'd read Rizal's profile twice. In addition, General Flood, who knew Rizal well, had told Rapp the man didn't trust people who talked too much. Instead, Rapp casually extracted a file from the flash bag on his lap and handed it over to him. He watched the general don a pair of reading glasses and then watched some more in silence as the man sitting next to him grew more and more irritated with each passing page. General Rizal closed the file and removed his reading glasses. His expression was unreadable. In a very precise manner, the older man placed his reading glasses in a case and stowed them in his breast pocket. He looked down at the file resting on his knee and sadly shook his head. "So, General Moro is a traitor." "Unless you have another explanation, that would appear to be the case."
The general frowned.
I have none.
Rizal still had yet to make eye contact with Rapp.
In fact, when I look back on certain events, this makes sense.
Rizal's stubby fingers tapped the file.
Abu Sayyaf, moving so freely, twice being cornered but miraculously escaping both times. We were all convinced that if Moro and his vaunted commandos couldn't hunt down the rebels, then no one could.
The general shook his head.
How could I have been so blind?
Were you friends? Asked Rapp.
No, said Rizal, without emotion. I never liked the man. But he has his supporters. He is very smooth politically. And his men love him. He has created his own cult of personality, something that has concerned me and a few others for some time.
Rapp liked the sound of that. Through the profiles that the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency had provided, Rapp already knew Moro's commandos were fiercely loyal to him. This, combined with the new information that Moro had enemies within the general staff, made Rapp confident that he could sell his plan without having to twist any arms. What would his men do if he was relieved of his command?
I'm not sure.
The American's implication was obvious.
I can recall him to Manila on any one of a dozen pretenses, all of them seemingly legitimate, but going public with arresting him, that will be the tricky part. He has many allies, some of them wildly popular and very anti-American. They will say that you framed him.
Rizal sadly shook his head and added,
And there are many people in my country who will want to believe that.
Looking out the window, he added, in a defeated voice,
Our military is very weak right now. I don't know how we will survive a scandal of this magnitude.
Rapp saw his chance. There's another way out of this, sir. For the first time, Rizal made eye contact. Moro has broken his oath as an officer, Rapp started. He's a traitor, plain and simple. Rapp pointed to the file. This is just the tip of the iceberg, by the way. If you brought him up on a court-martial, he'd be buried under the evidence and ultimately sentenced to death. You can choose to go that route, or we can try something else.
I'm listening.
Rapp hesitated only briefly. I want his head. His dark eyes never left the general's. Two U.S. Navy SEALs are dead because of him. And a family of innocent non-combatants are still being held hostage because Moro has aided and abetted the enemy. If we arrest him, he will be court-martialed, and despite the politics of the situation, he will be convicted and more than likely sentenced to death. But as you've pointed out, such a trial will severely damage our two countries' relationship and the image of the Philippine Army. Easing back, Rapp added, I think both of us would prefer to see this problem dealt with in a more subtle way. Rizal thought about this for a minute. He knew exactly what the American was getting at.
What would you need from me?
Rapp carefully examined the general and then began to lay out his plan. By mid-morning, the problem would be neutralized, and the Philippine people would have a martyr to rally behind in their battle against the Muslim rebels. Chapter 17. Cruising at 600 miles per hour, the Gulfstream jet made the relatively short hop from Manila to Samar Island in just under an hour and touched down at an unlit private landing strip near the southern tip of the island. It came to a brief stop at the end of the runway, just long enough for Coleman and his men to deplane, and then raced back down the asphalt and into the star-filled sky. The four men stood in silence as the roar of jet engines was replaced by the jungle's nocturnal murmuring. They were still well outside the combat zone, but they all instinctively spread out, each man putting his eyes on a different sector. They were in jungle fatigues, their faces smeared with grease paint and their weapons dangling at their sides. The airstrip and the acreage surrounding it belonged to a Japanese businessman. He'd bought the 1,200-acre plantation and built himself a magnificent home overlooking the ocean and an 18-hole golf course for his private amusement. Rapp had his people at the CTC, CIA's Counterterrorism Center, do a few discreet inquiries and discovered that the home was rarely used during the week and was currently unoccupied. There was a caretaker on the premises, but they would be long gone by the time he rubbed the sleep from his eyes and came to investigate. Two of the former SEALs, Kevin Hackett and Dan Strobel, donned their night vision goggles and moved off in opposite directions, their MP-10 suppressed submachine guns hanging at their sides. Coleman chose not to put on his NVGs, looking off in the distance at the big house on the hill now washed by moonlight. He took a small pair of field binoculars from his chest pocket to get a closer look at the house. A couple of exterior lights were on, but otherwise the place was black. A single light shone from the gatehouse across the drive from the main house. Coleman studied the structure for a time and was looking at the front door when the caretaker stepped outside. A slight frown creased his brow as he silently hoped their ride would arrive before he had to deal with this problem. The fourth man arrived silently at Coleman's side.
"The chopper's on its way in."
Coleman tilted an ear toward the sky, but heard nothing. He looked down at Charlie Wicker and nodded. He trusted Wicker's senses more than his own. In fact, he trusted Wicker's eyes and ears more than probably any other soldier he'd ever worked with. Barely 5'6", Wicker was almost elfish in appearance. He was the best sniper Coleman had ever seen in action and had been handpicked by Rapp for the operation. Wicker was the only active-duty man on the team. Rapp had cheap-dipped him from SEAL Team 6. When they got into position, Wicker would be the star of the show. A full 10 seconds after Wicker had alerted him, Coleman heard the thumping noise of helicopter rotors against the heavy tropical air. The MH-60G Pave Hawk helicopter came in fast, skimming the tops of the trees and then passing over the heads of Coleman and his men. It flared out immediately like a horse being pulled back in by its reins, its tail landing gear looking like it would hit the tarmac hard. At the last minute, the wheel stabilized a mere foot above the ground until the front landing gear came into line. The menacing bird set down gently without the aid of its heavy-duty shock absorbers. Coleman and his men watched all of this with great interest. They expected the best, and it looked like they'd got it. The bird belonged to the Air Force Special Operations Command. It was part of the 353rd Special Operations Group out of Kadena Air Base in Japan. The specifics of the op had been taken care of on the flight over. Rapp had given Coleman the mission objective and told him to organize the details. Anything he needed was to be routed through General Campbell at the Joint Special Operations Command back at Fort Bragg. Coleman had one request, and it was pretty simple but very important. He asked for the best flight crew available. As evidenced by the failed mission to rescue the Andersons, the most dangerous part of any op was usually the insertion and the extraction. Coleman stopped just outside the open door of the helicopter and slapped each of his men on the back as they bounded in. When they were all on board, he climbed in and stuck his head into the cockpit. The pilot turned to look at him, his night vision goggles perched atop his black flight helmet in the up position. Coleman handed the man a piece of white paper with a GPS coordinate on it. "Bring us in low, just above the canopy, and we'll fast rope down." The pilot nodded. Neither warrior attempted an introduction. All parties involved understood there would be no official record of what they were doing. The pilot punched the coordinates into the bird's advanced Pave Hawk avionics computer, and Coleman buckled himself in for what he was sure would be a wild ride. Chapter 18. When David entered Monsignor Levin's office, the first thing he noticed was caution in the eyes of the normally jovial priest. It was not the sign the Palestinian was looking for. With everything he had worked for hinging on this evening's meeting, he was growing increasingly nervous as the appointed hour approached. One mistake now, one misread, would very likely lead to a brutal death at the hands of his own people. Studying the priest with a discerning eye, David asked, "What is wrong?" Levin shook his head and said, "Nothing." He pointed at the door behind him and then looked at some papers on his desk. Something was amiss, but what it was, David hadn't a clue.
He hesitated briefly, and then willed his feet to march him to the door. He had a feeling that on the other side of it something awaited him that he wouldn't like. When he opened the door, his instincts proved correct. There, sitting in the dim light, in his usual spot at the far end of the conference table, was Abe Spielman. This time, however, a shadowy figure sat next to him. David could not make out any features, but he didn't need to. The large, bald head and bull-like shoulders could only belong to one man. It was Ben Friedman. The name alone inspired hatred and fear in many. In David's case, at least, it also inspired a begrudging respect. In the entire West Bank, there was perhaps no other man more loathed than Ben Friedman. As the Director General of Mossad, it was Friedman's job to wage a covert war with Israel's enemies. The Israeli Defense Forces were in charge of dealing with a menagerie of terrorist groups within the occupied territories in a more overt manner, but it was Mossad's job to take on the particularly nasty operations. Friedman had been the chief architect of many such actions over the last two decades. As David's eyes adjusted to the dim lights, he got a better look at the man. Though they had never met, the two enemies stared at each other with the familiarity of lifelong rivals. Neither spoke, and the tension continued to build. Spielman, nervous that his friend might turn around and leave, offered an apology for bringing a guest.
"Jabril, I am sorry for surprising you like this, but I can explain."
David's eyes left Friedman's and looked at his old friend. He decided, for now, not to reply. Even though he was caught off guard that their little two-person club had a new member, he knew he shouldn't have been. The information that he had given Spielman during their last meeting was bound to wake up some people at the Institute, as Mossad was commonly referred to by insiders. Slowly, David walked closer to the two men and grabbed a chair, not the one right next to Spielman, as he normally did, but one a few away. The message was clear. He would listen, but it would not be business as usual. The other thing he hoped to convey was his mistrust of a monster like Friedman. Always the pragmatist, though, David knew the Director General of Mossad was a nemesis that the bloodthirsty Palestinian leadership had created. It was a case of action and reaction. Absent his normal charm, David looked to Spielman and said,
"I didn't know we were allowed to bring visitors. I'm sure I could have found someone to join us."
Spielman didn't laugh.
"Believe me, it wasn't my idea."
Inside, the elderly professor was still seething over Friedman's dictum that he would accompany him to the meeting. It made no difference that when Friedman was a case officer, he recoiled at any attempt by his superiors to meet one of his assets. In Spielman's harsh opinion, Friedman was a control freak and a bully, and a man who fanned the flames of Palestinian-Israeli hatred. He was exactly the type of person that could upset the hard-fought and delicate friendship he had cultivated with Jabril. Knowing Spielman well enough, David could tell that he was sincere. He gave him a slight nod, signaling that he was willing to take him at his word, at least for now. Leaning forward out of the shadows, Friedman placed his brawny forearms on the table and in a raspy voice asked,
"Do you know who I am?"
"Of course." David maintained an almost disinterested attitude. He'd read the PLO's meager file on the man and had heard many stories. Born in Jerusalem in 1949, Friedman went on to distinguish himself in the Six-Day War of 1967. After the war, he was transferred to Amman, Israel's military intelligence organization, and then later Mossad. At Mossad, he became a very effective kidon, or, in the common parlance of the business, an assassin. He specialized in hunting down members of Yasser Arafat's Force 17. His tenacious ability to track people across multiple continents made him a greatly feared warrior in the struggle for his people's security.
"I have kept an eye on you," stated Friedman, "for many years, and have been looking forward to this day for some time."
David wondered if he meant simply meeting him or meant wrapping his large hands around his throat and choking him to death. It was quite possibly a bit of both, for he had no doubt that Ben Friedman was cut from the same cloth as the militant terrorists who governed his own people. The enemy was the enemy, and there was no need to analyze it much further than that. There was no distinction or recognition of the individual. The condemnation was made of the entire Palestinian society, and conversely of all Israelis. It was this line of thinking that allowed these men to launch blunt attacks with no concern over who was killed. It was the rationale that allowed them to sleep at night and claim that their cause was the truly just one. There were many directions David could take this. There were many questions, in fact, that he would very much like to ask the dark angel who was sitting across from him, but there were schedules to be kept, goals to be met, and a country to be made. Besides, it was somewhat comforting to know that during the course of the next 2 weeks, the man sitting across from him would feel pressure like he'd never felt before. Eschewing anything controversial and swallowing his pride, David said, "And I have looked forward to meeting you." Friedman smirked, as if to say he doubted the sincerity of the comment, and then said, "Tell me, Jabril, and excuse me if I sound distrustful, but it is my nature. This meeting tonight, why would all of these people risk gathering in one place?" David wondered how good Friedman's intelligence was. It was highly likely that he had assets who could give him pieces to the complex puzzle. Those pieces on their own would prove nothing, but they might raise or lower his level of cynicism. Truthfully, he answered, "It is not that unusual for them to gather under one roof." The bald man looked skeptical.
"The leaders of Hamas, the head of the Palestinian General Intelligence, and the leaders of Force 17. This is a common occurrence, that they all get together to plot the destruction of my people?"
David stayed the course.
"Yes. I find it hard to believe they could stand the sight of each other."
"Let's just say they are united in their hatred of you and their desire for money."
This ends Disc 3.